What's cracking, folks? Welcome back. Podcast Paroxysm. We are taping this at night and posting in the morning now. We're trying something new. I just got back from Montreal, and Jordan is in a new house. Very happy for you. How's it going?
It's going okay.
That's it?
How's Canada?
Canada was fun. It's weird. They have so many extra letters in their words. I don't like it. And I know I make fun of Sierra all the time with her extra U's in every word, but they were adding like an E into blue. Like Labatt Blue is spelled B-L-E-U-E. I don't like it. No. Blue is spelled B-L-U-E.
I'm just throwing it. It's too foreign a world for you, wasn't it?
It's not that it's too foreign of a world. It's more just like, you know, I like things. We'll stick with that. Especially the way the word blue...
Jared Dubin, he likes things.
The way the word blue is spelled is one of the things that I like. And they changed it up on me, and it threw me for a loop. I gotta say, it did. Anyway, I think that's a perfect transition that we're gonna start talking about the Golden State Warriors. Iguodala, good move. Liked it a lot.
It's surprising, really.
I mean, I wrote like 2,600 words at Grantland about the possible destinations for Andre Iguodala in free agency, and I did not mention Golden State once at all. So, yeah. I was a little surprised.
So you just kind of did it just to probably rub it in your face, I'm guessing.
Well, I mean, why else would he have done it?
Right.
I mean, it was, I guess it was, if you can't stop him, join him kind of thing.
Something like that. And then, you know, not to mention that with the pitfall in Denver and the just mass exodus or firing, he probably didn't want to stick around there for too long. Plus, he wasn't totally happy with everybody there.
He wasn't? We know that?
No. No.
Oh, alright.
conjecture on my part.
Sorry?
Sorry. Pure conjecture on my part. No, but like, there were times when he would just, I don't know, it just seemed like some of the comments made where he, like, not everybody was, like, taking defense at, not as seriously, but like, put as much effort into the defensive end as he was. And for a guy who prides himself on defense, you know, it's going to upset you, obviously.
Obviously. And, you know, that was – they made their first really significant jump in defense last year, Denver.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, he came there –
hugely responsible for it.
Of course, yeah. And, you know, he talked to Ethan Strauss about that this week. I read something that Ethan wrote – where Iguodala said that he feels that he was, you know, very heavily responsible for their improvement in defense, which obviously he was. You know, I wouldn't necessarily venture to say mostly responsible, but he was obviously a huge part of them getting a lot better at defense. You know, and they went from 19th to 11th in defensive efficiency from the season before to last season. And him, Kostakoufis, a little bit of Corey Brewer, Gallo. But, I mean, him and Kufis, I feel like, were the main two guys. Obviously, with Iguodala on the wing, Kufis down low.
Yeah.
But now, you know, he's going to Golden State. And, I mean we're going to talk a little bit about this in the preview where... And sorry, that's the Hardwood Paroxysm season preview coming October 19th. They have so many wings now. I feel like it's going to be tough to get them on the court at the same time, just because if you're going small with Barnes at the four, that means that you have to play them with Bogut, I feel like, because you can't play him with Lee, just be too bad defensively.
Right.
And counting on Bogut to be healthy all year is a proposition you're probably not going to win all the time. Like, the guy's going to be hurt at some point.
Obviously, it's a good signing for them. But yeah, you're right. They do have a glut of wings now. So do you think...
Not that it's a problem to have too many good wings. Like,
no, it's not. Especially when like their wings have such a diverse skill set. Like,
right.
They've kind of got one wing for every situation, basically.
Yeah, that I would say that that's about right. And, I mean... People were concerned, you know, they lost Jarrett Jack, who did a lot of ball handling for them in situations where they played him with both Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, but
sometimes too much ball handling.
Right, that's what I was going to say first. Sometimes too much ball handling and too much shooting. But also, Iguodala is such a good ball handler and such a good passer that he could easily pick up some of that slack. Plus then, you know, rather than having Stephen Curry not handling the ball, just give him some of those possessions back. Let him play on the ball more. He's such a dangerous player working off of screens, both on and off the ball, but I feel like he's more dangerous with the ball in his hands just because that trigger is so quick on his jumper, and I feel like he's one of the rare players who he can get his shot off quicker off the dribble than just catch and shoot.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think also he's just got that confidence, and it's like a Jamal Crawford-esque confidence where, like, he'll pull up and shoot it from anywhere. And most of the time, it's actually a decent shot, and so, yeah, I think you definitely want... And he's such a terrific passer, too. Why wouldn't you want the ball in his hands more?
And just speaking of, you know, anywhere he shoots, it's a good shot. Andrew Lynch wrote that piece a couple weeks ago about, you know, the really deep shooters and who shoots the best from 27 plus feet, I think it was. And obviously Steph Curry was number one on that list because
hardly surprising.
Right. I mean, yeah, he's Steph Curry. The dude doesn't miss. Like that series against Denver was absurd. It was just like, yeah, I mean, is there another word for what Steph Curry was like in that series?
It was absolutely ridiculous. And, like, you feel so bad for Ty Lawson because he's a really good player. It's just, like, he's very short, and Steph Curry could just shoot over him all day, and he did, and just would not miss, could not miss. It was incredible.
When you're that... Like, I mean, I don't want to be so blunt about it, but when you're that size, like, guys can shoot over you, and it's a real shortcoming on defense. And that Lawson, I mean, he's a solid-ish defender most of the time, but in that series, he was exposed greatly in terms of how it's not very easy for him to contest shots.
Yeah, and more importantly, it just showed how... Well, not more importantly, but it also just showed how quick Curry is to get his shot off in any situation. But I think we should also talk about Klay Thompson, obviously, because, you know, Harrison Barnes, he had a surprising rookie year. It was good, but it was also just surprising in the way that he fit, because, you weren't quite sure how he was going to play it, but, you know, as the season progressed, he looked really good. Klay Thompson, on the other hand, didn't take the jump that everybody expected him to. In fact, his PER was down by 2.2 points from 14.9 to 12.7. True shooting percentage was down about from 54% to 53%. Well, his win shares went up, which is interesting. It went to 4.3 up from 1.7, but at the same time, he just never saw like that leap that everybody expected out of him this year.
Well, I think that, you know, part of that is so many people, and I'm guilty of this too, assume that improvement is just linear, and it happens in a gradual progression every year where you just get better on, you know, a certain scale, and it just happens automatically.
Right,
and it's not actually like that. And, you know, while, yes, he did, regress in some areas of game, there were signs of a better player in there too, I think. You know, especially on defense, I feel like he worked harder to get through and around screens on defense last year and was better about not straying too far from his man for, you know, when he's digging down on pick and rolls and then to get back to his man on the perimeter to contest a shot. There were, obviously he struggled in certain situations last season, but there were signs of improvement as well. I don't want it to seem like he just got worse last year.
No,
I don't think that's true.
But I'm just saying, like, a lot of people kind of expect just that hugely dynamic backcourt of Curry and Thompson, and they do look good, especially in the playoffs. Like, they looked terrific.
Right, and this is just, you know, this is still a guy that on 6.4 attempts a game shot 40% from three.
Yeah,
like,
still really really good shooter.
And an incredibly valuable player.
And he's become really good, and this was always kind of his strength, but he, I mean, especially getting the playoffs last year, he's really good moving without the ball, and I think that's just going to continue to be a strength of his. And if he raises, you know, his game in other areas, he did look really good on defense last, at least in the playoffs throughout the regular season. He was kind of up and down, but no, I agree with you. It's progression isn't linear, like improvement isn't linear.
I mean, for some guys, it is. You know, a guy like you look like Durant and Westbrook, basically.
Durant, yeah.
Those guys seem like they've just gotten gradually a little bit better every year. But not everybody is like that. You know, sometimes it happens in fits and starts.
Yeah, and some guys get better in one aspect than they do the other. And, you know, evolution is just different for every player.
Right. And then, you know, quickly on Barnes, I feel like for most of the regular season, he didn't fit very well there. It wasn't necessarily that they were trying to shoehorn him into lineups where he didn't fit, but it was just that, you know, he's the kind of guy where he's going to do his scoring without the ball a lot of the time, and because he's not yet that great off the dribble. But their only real creator for others in the starting lineup was Curry. Off the bench. He was coming off the bench with Jack, who, while a very solid player, he's a guy that looks for his shot more often than he does to pass. And I feel like Barnes needed to get in there with Curry and Lee and the guys who are, you know, unselfishly moving the ball around the court for him to be able to really do what he does best. And then, you know, obviously in the playoffs when they went to small ball, him being able to stretch the floor for them was huge. And that's why a lot of people are excited about the potential of, you know, getting Curry, Thompson, Iguodala, and Barnes all on the court at the same time.
I think it's going to be good. I think it'll be exciting. I think Curry's obviously not the best defender. He does try, but I think that's that lineup with a healthy Bogut. Because, I mean, Bogut last year it was against the Spurs and against the Knicks, just loved the Bogut of old, who was an incredible, underrated defender.
Well, it was against Denver, too.
That's what I'm saying. Like, Bogut was always a very underrated defender. And he looked just terrific against them. So, you know, you get those however many, maybe 20, 30 games of healthy Bogut? I think that's 20 to 30 games of 100% or near 100% Bogut. That's going to be a really good defensive lineup.
Yeah. I mean, just between Iguodala, Thompson and Bogut, the three of them, you know, if you get anything defensively, if you can get average performances defensively out of Barnes and Curry with that lineup, it's going to be a really good defensive line, even while giving up, you know, size and rebounding and within that. Are you worried at all about the Warriors' defense now that they've lost Michael Malone?
Curious to see what happens with it, because we never know what the division of labor was between Jackson and Malone and all the other coaching staff in terms of offense and defense. So we don't know. Is it going to be like when Thibodeau left the Celtics for the Bulls and the Celtics still had a very good defense, or is it going to be one of those things where like the defense basically collapses? I think they'll be okay because I think, if nothing else, Malone instilled within both Jackson and the players the keys to like his defense, and they know the strategies, they know the fundamentals of it. So what's to keep them from at least holding that same system? Adjustment wise, I don't know. We'll see if Jackson or whoever the assistant that he puts in charge of defense, or if he takes charge of the defense, is able to make those defensive adjustments like Malone was.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on all counts there. I think it will be, you know, an interesting test case of a season for us to see Mark Jackson's true level of coaching ability. Like, obviously, it's clear that he's a good coach. He's established that over his two seasons with the Warriors. But I think it was also generally widely assumed that he was getting a bunch of help on the defensive side of the ball with Mike Malone, considered one of the best assistants in the league. And it's not often that you think about an assistant coach leaving as a huge development for a team, but I think that in this specific situation, it has to be considered one.
Oh, I think it's certainly going to factor in. I don't think their defense is going to entirely collapse.
Oh, no, neither do I, especially because, you know, they signed Iguodala, who makes every defense he's on fantastic. You know, the Denver...
Yeah, and I think...
Yeah, I mean, Denver jumped from 19th to 11th in 1 year, and when he was on the court, it was a top five defense. Like, when him and Kufis and Corey Brewer all played together, they allowed something like, you know, 92, 93 points per 100 possessions, something like that, that would have led the league by, you know, two, three points. You know, right. You get him on your defense and put him with one or two other competent defenders, and it's like you can't be scored on.
What I like about Iguodala here on the Warriors is he's going to be, this term is a little cliche, but he's like that defensive coach on the floor. Like, yeah, you've got someone like Bogut who's going to be able to do that, but he can't, you know, stretch out to the perimeter. He's not as agile, obviously not able to cover as many positions as Iguodala does. And so I just think, like, you know, he's not going to replace Malone, obviously, in terms of coaching, but it just having that guy who's able to direct the defense, that's huge.
Yes, absolutely. Although I gotta say, I mean, and we can just add this to the long list of things that I don't like. I don't like the phrase "coach on the floor." It's not that I don't believe in it, because obviously some guys are like that. I just really don't like the turn of phrase. Like, it's one of those things. I just don't like it. I can't even tell you why. It's just, it irks me.
Nice. Irks. Irks a good one.
Irks is a good word. Irks is in my top like 3,000 favorite words to use.
Okay, that's a bit much. So, Mark Jackson, tying it back to this real quick, do you think he's coach of the year candidate if he gets his team to the second round of the playoffs again?
I don't think where he gets in the playoffs matters in coach of the year voting, because it's voted on at the end of the regular season.
Let me back up. Do you think, given his recent success, and then like if he's able to carry that over now with Malone gone, you know, and he's got a defensive star in Iguodala, do you think he could win coach of the year?
I do think that he's a coach of the year candidate, especially if they make a jump to something like 55 wins. You got to remember, that team only won 47 games last year. Obviously, it was a big improvement from the year before, but it's not like they were winning. Like, I feel like people think they were a better overall team last season than they were, just because of how amazing that first round series was. But if they make, you know, an 8 to 10 win jump this year, and then obviously, yes, he's going to be in the discussion. Although I don't think, like, even though we talked about it as, you know, something that would be a fairly big deal, I don't think necessarily that Mike Malone leaving would have an effect on whether or not he's a candidate for coach of the year. Do you? Or was that just like a, you know, you threw it in there?
No, it's, I mean, I don't think it's, I only meant that insofar as, like, now it's, I don't want to say it's like, no, it's his team. He's the goddamn head coach. Of course it's his team. But it's like, he doesn't have that, not even looming off over his shoulder, but it's more just like, oh, well, that's Malone responsible for that. It's like, well, no, now it's totally Jackson. Maybe. What? I was just thinking of things that, like, might have affected
him. Moving on.
Yeah.
Kent Bazemore.
Yeah. Summer League superstar.
Summer League superstar, all around good guy, going crazy. They have included his celebratory dances in NBA 2K, apparently.
I've heard several from several sources within the league call him the best towel waver in the league. So that's pretty high praise.
Is it even close? Like, who else is in the discussion then?
No one. His towel efficiency rating, developed by John Tallinger, is just absolutely off the charts.
All right, we're just going to pretend that you didn't say that right there. Also, they have Tony Douglas now, so
your good, favorite player.
Good on them for collecting former Knicks that drive me crazy. Oh, God, Tony Douglas. Even if he didn't go to Florida State, I still would not like him. But he did, so he's the worst.
But he was a major player in We'll Always Have Linsanity.
Well, yeah, he was a major player because he sucked. He was like the worst. His true shooting that season, I just tried to Google it and I put Trony shooting percentage instead of Tony Douglas. But I mean, it was just, oh God, he was the worst. Tony, and that's like, I have a thing where when point guard, by the way, his true shooting that season was .393. Yes, a 39.3 true shooting percentage. I have a thing where when a point guard just is running the pick and roll, and then he sees the screen in front of him, and all he does is just dribble to the other side of the screener. You know, he doesn't try to probe the lane. He doesn't try to get around and go one way or the other or make any kind of move either toward or away from the basket or, like, even think about throwing a pass. That's called Tony Douglas saying a pick and roll.
I just remember you and Network tweeting incessantly about everything wrong with Tony Douglas throughout the season.
Oh, God. We did have some great conversations. Although, you know what? When we did the CBS podcast with Harper, when we were promoting the book, it was like there was like a 3-minute thing that I think it got cut out because I was cursing about just me railing on about Tony Douglas. Good. Oh, we're moving on. We're talking about the Grizzlies.
Okay.
I can't think about Tony Douglas anymore.
You can't do it anymore.
So I wrote our HP's Hi, How Was Your Summer piece about the Grizzlies. And I gave a bunch of thoughts about them. So I want to hear your thoughts on Memphis's summer.
Well, Matt successfully converted me to the Church of Gasol this past season. Watching him was just a complete joy. I don't know even how else to express it. Like, it's a complete joy to watch him play basketball. And, you know, I think it's good that he's taking on more of the leadership, like the...
They've got the moves and the mottos.
What is that? That is an ad on HP that I just opened.
Today we're counting down.
One of our ads is apparently, because I opened my Hi, How Was Your Summer about the Grizzlies, and apparently one of our ads, our new ads, is an autoplay ad. So it came on in the background, and that's going to stay on the podcast because I suck at editing.
Sorry, folks. Anyways, in summation, I love Marc Gasol. His passing is just an absolute thing of beauty. His jump shot, I mean, it's not really a jump shot because he doesn't exactly jump. It just looks so effortless, both when it leaves his hand and when it just swishes through the net.
Well, when you don't jump on a jump shot, it probably is fairly effortless.
No, but just like the flick of his wrist looks like it's he's
I
not
know
even
what
trying.
You meant. I was just, you know.
Don't be a dick.
I was needling you.
Don't be a dick.
You know,
also, Mike Conley, you and I are both obviously very big fans of Mike Conley.
The Shadow Master.
The Shadow Master. We didn't talk about this because this one, the podcast that we tried to do didn't work. Zach Harper, this was during the Spurs-Grizzlies series, made a really interesting observation that watching Mike Conley go up against Tony Parker is almost like a guy battling his reflection. They're very similar in the way that they operate in the pick and roll, in the way they just kind of probe just above the elbow and kind of throughout the lane. It was a really interesting observation, and you know, when you go back and kind of watch it, really makes a lot of sense. But Conley was finally recognized last year. Was he first team or second team all defense?
I'm not sure, actually. I generally don't pay attention to all defense teams because they're consistently pretty terrible.
Yeah, they are, but I mean, I'm just saying, he's starting to get that recognition that he
has. Oh, yeah, I mean, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, you well know how much I love Mike Conley. I consistently rave about how, I wouldn't say it's fun necessarily to watch him play, but it's just, it's fulfilling just because he plays.
Ooh, I like that.
It's fulfilling to watch Mike Conley. It is.
Mike Conley is fulfilling.
Well, it's fulfilling to watch Mike Conley. I don't know if he's fulfilling. I really like the way he works angles out of the pick and roll. And Matt and Zach Lowe were talking a few weeks ago about who the best guys are at dribbling away from the screen on pick and rolls. And I mentioned Conley as one of those. I think he's really, really good at, you know, just deciding when to reject the screen. Obviously, it helps that his screeners are Marc Gasol and Zach Randolph, who are just massive humans. But I really do think he has good decision-making in terms of when to try to go for that move. And then, obviously, the righty floater is just a thing of beauty.
It's ridiculous. It's really tremendous how much development you've seen out of him, and then also out of Gasol, too.
Well, just quickly before you go on this, is there anyone else that's known for a specific type of play or shot with their offhand like Conley is?
I don't think there's anyone as marketed about it.
No, I mean, there was the time that Larry Bird shot that lefty three.
Right, but I think that's... Oh, and Sheed. I mean, Sheed.
Sheed. And then Jordan switching hands in the air.
Right. Hey, maybe Tristan Thompson?
Oh, Tristan Thompson. Right. Good call.
I mean, we have yet to see the fruits of that labor, really.
No. Although, I mean, it can't possibly be worse than his free throw shooting the last couple of years. I feel like you could shoot with no hands and do better than that.
Oh, that'd be interesting to see.
It's probably been done before. Anyway, so the Grizzlies won 56 games, and then they fired their coach. Or they didn't fire their coach, they just didn't bring him back.
Is important to note, because a lot of people still, I've heard people just, talking. I heard this, around the Orlando Summer League. I heard this at Vegas Summer League. You know, we've seen on Twitter. It's why would you fire Lionel Hollins? They didn't fire him.
Well, that's also, and this happened during the lockout. You know, you'd talk with people who aren't necessarily, obsessively following it like we were at the time. And they're like, I can't believe the players are striking. Like, no, they're not striking. They're being locked out. It's a much different thing. It's the exact opposite.
Isn't just semantics. This
it's the exact opposite of a strike.
Yeah. But yeah, I just want to hear your thoughts about it, about not bringing back Hollins versus, promoting. Was it Jordan? Is that how you pronounce his name?
It's Jaeger.
It's Jaeger. Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Obviously, if the coach and the front office are not on the same page, that's not good for... It's not good for either side, and it's not good for the team. It's not good for morale. Regardless of how hard the players want to work for the coach or for the front office, whichever one is the one that, ownership sides with. It's just not good to have everybody not being on the same page. So I understand the decision to let him go, even though obviously he had great success over the last few years there. And he was kind of, almost as much as Tony Allen, his personality was embedded in that grit and grind culture in Memphis. But I think that the fact that they're promoting from within helps keep that continuity around. But, I mean, it's not often that you see a team win a franchise record number of games and then move on from their coach. It's definitely unusual, but I feel like it's going to be... If there's a situation where it could be okay, I feel like Memphis is that situation. But I also feel like, with Z-Bo getting up there in age, And with Tayshaun already up there in age, they could be in for a drop off. Even if they got, I think they did get a little bit better this summer by adding, adding Mike Miller. They got Calathes to come over from, I think he was in Greece, and they drafted Jamal Franklin. They re-signed Tony Allen. So they brought back basically their entire core, except for they swapped Darrell Arthur to Denver for Kostakouvas. So, I mean, they added a bunch of guys to make their team deeper and more versatile this year, and I feel like they could still win fewer games, not be as high of a seed, and maybe not go as far in the Western Conference playoffs, just because so many other teams made leaps and because of the way that their roster is situated in terms of the age of both Randolph and Prince.
Right. I mean, we saw what happened with Randolph in the playoffs last year. Like, he was just...
Well, that was also, he was coming off an injury. I feel like it's a different thing.
He's a year older. He's probably slower. Maybe he'll be fresh, but, like, at the same time, that wear and tear, it becomes faster just as you get older. And so, like, but more of the point was, like, so if one of those key pieces breaks down, like Randolph, you saw how much they struggled and how much it puts a burden on the rest of the players, and I mean, of their starters. Really, the only guys who can really score consistently are Gasol, Conley, and it puts more burden on them, and that's not good.
Well, I don't necessarily know if those are the only guys that can score.
I'm saying of their starters. No, those aren't the only guys who can score, but I mean, when they try out that starting five, I don't even know if Prince is going to start this year.
Well, I think it's also a thing where, you know, after they traded Rudy Gay, then truly Conley was their only off-the-dribble creator.
Yeah.
Gasol and Randolph can both create shots, but it's not like they're, you know, and obviously they can draw defenders in certain ways, each of them, but it's not like they're, you know, driving kick guys where you can pull people from all over the court.
Right, and they had Bayless, but he's not going to do that for you. He's much more of a shoot first, shoot second, maybe pass third guy.
Also, he's evil.
You're not a Jared Bayless fan.
No, I'm a huge Jared Bayless fan, but have you seen what he looks like these days? The dude,
he looks like Baby Boozer.
He looks like an evil genius. You weren't in on like the whole evil Bayless meme last year?
I mean, I was, but I was with the whole Baby Boozer thing even before that.
See, I like Bayless too much to get in on Baby Boozer. I mean, he really does just look like an evil mastermind.
Yeah, he does. He does.
He does have a nicely shaved head, though. He's see, I study this kind of thing because I have a fully shaved head, so I always notice when dudes have, like, weird-shaped heads. Jared Bayless has a very nicely shaped head. Are you telling me that you don't notice this kind of stuff? Like, I think you're out of your mind.
I fortunately still have hair, probably for the next 2 years. Once I lose it, though, which hurts my family, then maybe I'll start noticing it, and then I'll get on that train. But for now, I'll leave those observations to you. Maybe with the new Sport View cameras and all the data that we're going to get, maybe that'll help you.
Sport View just gives the XY coordinates, though, so it's not like they're tracking, you know, the actual physical body.
No, but, like, it also shows, the player, I think, doesn't it, in terms of, like, the video? So you can look at it from above, and you can see who has the most glean off their dome.
Speaking of that, when I was in my first year of law school, My roommate and I, I was already bald and had shaved my head, and he was, you know, losing a little bit of his hair. So we decided that we wanted to make a blog called baldspot.blogspot.com. And all we would do is, like, take pictures during every game of, like, Sheed's bald spot and Ginobili's bald spot, and then, like, any other player we found in any sport of their bald spot, and just post pictures of them. But we couldn't do it because apparently baldspot.blogspot.com
don't tell me it was registered.
Was already registered and existed. It has one blog post ever. from Tuesday, March 18th, 2003, that says, "Have you ever noticed that gravity is serious?" And that's the only post on baldspot.blogspot.com. So we never got to make the blog.
Because sometimes life isn't fair.
I mean, have you ever noticed that gravity is serious? You're telling, like, you would definitely read, or, I mean, I guess you wouldn't read it. You just go, I guess it's a better Tumblr, or Tumblr. I never know how to say that word.
It's Tumblr. There's no A.
Yeah, but it's Tumble, and then it's an R at the end. So, to me, I call it
Tumblr. So it's just Tumblr.
Nah, it's Tumblr.
For sure it's not.
We're calling it Tumblr, or I am at least. I think it would make, baldspot.blogspot.com would make for a better Tumblr than a blog.
But it just doesn't have roll off the tongue as much as baldspot.blogspot.com.
Right, baldspot.tumblr.com is terrible. Doesn't even make sense.
So, basketball.
What, you don't think that discussing Jared Bayless is...
I don't think discussing your dreams of
block spot. It came up organically, all right? what do you envision for Quincy Pondexter on this team this year? They kind of brought in Mike Miller to do similar things.
Pondexter's a better defender.
Obviously.
So, right. I really like him as that wing 3-and-D guy. He should have been playing more in the playoffs, which was, you know, it's not as if Hollins was completely totally infallible. Like, he did have some coaching mistakes and errors, or at least like what we would see as errors.
And a lot of that was in terms of lineup stuff. Like, he was the guy, I think, last year who said, you know, I don't want to see lineup analytics or whatever it was that he said.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, also, Pondexter had a great offseason. He got a date with Miss Tennessee over Twitter by asking who won Miss Tennessee or something
right,
like that.
And we've talked about this. I forgot when we mentioned this on the podcast. It might have been one or two podcasts ago. But again, John Hollinger, just with a terrific tweet of...
Right, the heat check. We talked about this last time.
Pondexter with the ultimate heat check.
Right, it was Pondextering.
So, yeah, I think... Hold on, let me look at what his numbers were last year. I think they'll remain mainly the same. I think he'll see an uptick in playing time, obviously. And, like, also more... not just, like, more minutes, but more quality minutes, too, like, in terms of, like, when they play him. Let's see. So, last year he scored, like, 6 points, 2 rebounds a game. Yeah, I think I see him scoring, like, maybe 10 points per game this season, but also providing very good defense and just that really valuable space that they lacked a lot last year.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's got to keep up. I mean, he shot 39.5% from three last year. I'm not sure if he'll necessarily shoot that well, but if he can shoot, you know, if he can shoot 37%, right, and obviously he was, you know, fantastic for them in the playoffs, and he provides something for them that Tayshaun Prince really doesn't. Even though Prince has been a solid percentage shooter from the outside for the last few years, Pondexter just provides so much more volume at that percentage and is such a more willing shooter.
Yeah.
Like,
Tayshaun Prince is a very willing shooter. It's just whether or not the shots are good.
I don't know if he's a willing outside shooter.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, he's a very willing shooter, but not when they're good shots. Like, there were a few times last year, like in the Oklahoma City series especially, he'd have the ball fairly open in the corner, just above the corner, three, and he'd pump fake, dribble in, try and back him down on the post, and then turn around and heave a jump shot. And this wasn't just once. He'd do this several times. Within a game, it's like, what? Why would you pass up that shot and take that horrible shot? So,
it's just all in an effort to make it from number 2 to number 1 on my most boring players in the NBA list.
That's all he was trying to do.
That's all. That doesn't make sense. Never mind. We're gonna pivot away from that joke I was just gonna make. Okay. There was something else I wanted to talk about with Memphis. Jaeger has already said, and this is something I harped on a bunch of times last year, that he wants them to get into their sets quicker this season. There were so many times last year and even over the last few years where they wouldn't cross half court until, you know, the minimum 16 seconds left on the shot clock, and then they're not getting into their sets until there's 8 to 10 seconds left on the clock. And it's like they run one thing and then a shot has to go up. If they're getting across with, you know, 17 or 18 or even 20 seconds left on the shot clock and get into their offense by 14 to 16 instead of 8 to 10, you know, that's the difference between being able to, you know, you get the ball on a kick out off of a pick and roll. That's the difference between having to take a shot right away and being able to throw a pump fake, take two dribbles, and pass it off to a cutter for a layup.
Right, right. And I really like that he said that instead of just like the cliche, you know, we're going to run more this year.
Yes, every team wants to run more every summer.
Every team wants to run more, but I like that because that's still pushing the pace, but it's not doing it just like just running. It's pushing the pace so that you get into your sets.
And it's like, also, you know, their personnel doesn't lend itself to we're going to run more, but they do need to. And you saw, you know, how much they struggled at times to score last year. They're a team that needs as long as possible to manufacture the movement and precise passing that is required for them to score points. So it's good for them to
faster. They just need longer possessions.
Right. It's good for them to give themselves that extra, you know, 4 to 6 seconds per possession, because it could really help a team that struggles to score a lot.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And then I also wanted to throw out there that they have Kostakoufos now. One of my favorite players in the league. I still call him the Koof. I'm trying to make that stick. Probably won't happen. But very solid backup center for them. Gives them a presence in the middle of the lane that can protect the rim. And especially if you get him out there ever with Tony Allen at all, I would imagine that they'll be similarly effective defensively as Kufis and Iguodala were.
The one thing that worries me about Kufis is he can't shoot. Arthur, at least, was able to shoot a little bit. That being said, I still think it's an upgrade. But yeah, it's just interesting that they that trade went down. More interesting and baffling for Denver than it was for Memphis, actually.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about Denver already, but
couldn't stay healthy.
That is, yes.
Huge issue.
And aren't you a Darrell Arthur guy? You went to Kansas, right?
Yeah, he went to Kansas. I do like Darrell Arthur. I think he could be a very solid role player, and he's shown the ability to be a solid role player.
I also he's think also that
shown the ability to not be healthy.
Well, yes, but what I was gonna say was I think that Darrell Arthur is one of the Kansas guys that Matt likes.
Yes,
he's like one of the only ones.
Which I'm surprised, like the earth hasn't shattered to its core.
Well, I think it's because he was on the Grizzlies.
Right, but still, I'm just surprised that Matt even deigns to acknowledge that he has some affection for a KU guy.
Also, quickly, before we move on to the next team, they got really good value in the draft with Jamal Franklin at the 44th pick, but it also was interesting because now it's like they're stockpiling guards that can't shoot. Right, it's like they think that that's the new market inefficiency. It's like Tony Allen can't shoot. Jamal Franklin can't shoot. Nick Calathes can't shoot. So I guess Calathes cannot shoot from the outside.
I thought he was supposed to be a pretty good outside shooter.
No, I'm pretty sure that he shoots like 20% from three.
And that's from the European three? Yikes.
Yeah, he's not a shooter. Yeah, he shot 27.5% from three last year in the Euro Cup.
Yikes.
And then that was after years of 27.5, 27.9 in the Greek League, 29.8 in the Euros the year before. 27.9, you know,
it's consistent. 40. Yeah, that's weird. And like at Florida, he was a good shooter. I guess just for some reason, the pros just wasn't.
I mean, it's possible. It's just a different style. Obviously, in Europe, it's different over there. But, yeah. Guards that can't shoot, market inefficiency.
It's interesting. Franklin's, I think, yeah, he's a very good athlete. He's also a bit better at the dribble. I mean, his handles are still shaky, but, and compared to, comparing anyone to Tony Allen in terms of handles, like, anybody looks like Jamal Franklin, or Jamal Crawford. But I like the Franklin pick, especially, like you said, the value of getting him in the second round. A lot of people thought he was going to be a first-round pick. It'll be interesting to see how they develop him. I think he's got the perfect person to learn from in Tony Allen.
And I also think like it's an underrated skill for wings to have. The fact that he's such a good rebounder, yeah. I think, will play an important role in how good he becomes.
And maybe especially because he's better.
Right, and well, that's where I was going to go. Rebounding is one of those things that generally tends to translate well from college to the NBA, and shooting is one of those things that can be taught. You know, guys can improve as shooters, whereas they don't necessarily, even with a lot of teaching, improve as rebounders. But let's go from there to the last team we're going to talk about today, the Thunder. Obviously, Westbrook's injury in last year's playoffs was depressing, for me at least. Let Westbrook be Westbrook.
Probably depressing for Oklahoma City as well.
Right. Well, you know, they got an idea of what life without Russell Westbrook is like, and it was not pretty.
No, it wasn't at all. That was like it was. KD was still scoring a ridiculous clip.
Well, I mean, he's just. The man is not human.
No, inhuman. The things he was able to do, and like with that added load of running the offense too from time to time, and still be able to put up those numbers and efficiently, oh my god, it was incredible. But that's not something you want for an entire season, obviously, which is why it's great that Russell Westbrook is back, even though he'll probably still have the same amount of detractors as he did before, because he's such a for some reason, such a polarizing figure.
For some reason. I wonder why.
Yeah.
Point guard purity. What I was going to say, though, I think you know, a major problem that surfaced when Westbrook went out was it's very much a situation like in Memphis. Those two guys are the only off the dribble, or I guess Reggie Jackson surfaced as an off the dribble creator as well by the end of the season. But at that point, Brooks was still playing Derek Fisher over him for some reason. Oh God.
It could happen again.
Could happen again. But like it really exposed the fact that Ibaka cannot create shots on his own. I think.
Right, well, and that was never something, I don't even think it was ever like assumed or like that was always a weakness. Bogus, but it also just exposed kind of Oklahoma City's offense in general.
Right. Well,
and I know you're not a fan of.
I don't think Scott we need Brooks. To go any more into my, you know, thoughts on Scott Brooks. It's well documented. But yes. What I meant with Ibaka, you know, because he's not a guy that can create for himself or really anyone else off the dribble, he's not equipped to take on extra usage when a guy like Westbrook goes down, just because he needs someone to create those shots for him. So it's not like you can just redistribute the possessions to him and say, okay, we're going to be fine, because that's a guy that's, you know, still very efficient and he can use those possessions. Well, no, because he needs someone to create the possessions that he uses for him. And that was Tom Ziller wrote about that on SB Nation last week. With his
that's a really good article.
Yeah, right, it was a fascinating article. He had done stuff with, you know, creation ratio before, but this was, you know, in terms of how many shots do you create per game, and what percentage of those are your shots, and what percentage are other people's shots, and you know, how often do you create your own shot? It was very interesting stuff, and Serge Ibaka he basically gets almost all of the shots created for him, and most of those come from Russell Westbrook. You know, their chemistry on that pick and pop play where Ibaka will set a screen like just above the elbow and Westbrook just comes flying around and Ibaka kind of floats to the free throw line area. And obviously they've gotten really, really good at that. It's like a, I don't know, it's like a dance almost, their chemistry together. And Westbrook has gotten really good at that kind of half shoulder wraparound pass to get it between the defenders to get it to Ibaka there. And then obviously he's so good when he's just coming around, blaring around that screen. He can either stop right at the elbow or pull up or take it all the way to the basket.
Right. Zoller says that Westbrook created about 25 shots for 36 minutes last season. And he also talked, he says that he was the number one creator in the NBA, which again, this just kind of goes back to like how many people think that he's not a point guard and like he's not a good player, which is just, that second was just stupid, but you know, when it was as far back as 2011, that he was the number one shot creator in the NBA, it's like, no, he is a very good point guard. He's very good at getting his teammates involved and creating, keyword there, for others and for himself. What are your thoughts on Jeremy Lamb? I mean, now that Kevin Martin's gone, obviously Thabo's still going to be the starter because they like him for his defense and just for that stability. But, you know, Lamb's got to step up in a big way this year because he's going to be that nominal sixth man. They're not going to run the offense. I mean, he's definitely not the same player Kevin Martin is. Do you think that, you know, that's a role that he's going to be able to fill? Do you think, like, or do you think they're in for some trouble? Not trouble, but there are going to be some struggles with him in that role.
Are we even sure that he's going to be the one filling that role? I think that Reggie Jackson's going to be the guy who's their, you know, six-man belt hole off the bench. I mean, I would hope it's going to be him and he's not still playing behind Derek Fisher. I mean,
I don't know if the plan is to play Reggie just at the one, or if they're comfortable playing him at the two, like next to Westbrook. We haven't really seen that lineup a whole lot.
Right. Well, you know, you're not counting on Scott Brooks to be innovative with lineups. I mean, you know, I'm not going to talk about Brooks. Let's talk about Nick Collison.
Oh boy.
What you want to just go off right here? You're gonna?
No, I don't want to just go off because it takes me a bit to just get my thoughts collected, obviously. But I love Nick Collison.
Who doesn't?
I don't know, but if there's someone who doesn't love Nick Collison, what is wrong with you? If you're listening to this podcast and you don't at least like Nick Collison, you're sick. You need to go seek help right away.
Collison is now looking at his third pick and roll partner in 3 years. Obviously, he worked magic with James Harden a couple seasons ago and, you know, for the few seasons before that. And then last year he had Kevin Martin. By the end of the season, they had some nice chemistry together. And now I guess it'll be either Jackson or Lamb or, you know, somebody else.
Derek Fisher.
Oh, Derek Fisher. I love Derek Fisher, man. He's my favorite player.
It's amazing how able players are to form that chemistry with Collison. Like, seeing him run that same action with Kevin Martin last year, where Martin Collison get the ball at the elbow, and you'd see Martin cutting, and Collison would just make that beautiful pinpoint pass to him right at the rim. It was deja vu, except, you know, you replace Kevin Martin's, you know, goatee with James Harden's ferocious beard. It's just insane, like how it's like clockwork. You just place one other player in there, and Nick Collison's going to find you with that great pass.
Kevin Martin has a goatee.
He had a goatee.
And yes, I know it's weird. That's the only thing I got from that. I don't think he does have a goatee.
I thought he had a goatee or some sort of facial hair.
He might have like a chin thing.
Like a soup catcher or like, a taste saver?
Like a little patch right there?
Yeah, he's got a bit of a patch and he's got a bit of a taste saver.
Bit of a what?
A taste saver? You know, it's like the thing that grows right under your lip. It's also called a soup catcher, so you know, yeah, soup. And then it catches it, and then you can, you know, it saves that taste for later.
That's weird. I just call it a chin thing.
I'm looking at his picture right now. He's got a little bit of the suit catcher, and he's also got some of the chin thing.
Yeah, he's got the chin thing working. Obviously, you know, James Harden's face thing is a little bit bigger.
Just a little bit.
So OKC, obviously, you know, they're getting Westbrook back. So much of the West got better this year, but I feel like they should still... A healthy Thunder team is still the best team in the West, I think.
Yeah, and that's what I think people are kind of forgetting. Like, with all the glitz and glamour of the Clippers, even though it's, like, weird saying that JJ Redick was a glamorous pickup or Doc Rivers was a glamorous pickup, like, they're still the one that got all the attention.
Well, and I think that Houston got a little bit of the attention as well.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Houston?
Yeah, I know. No, but what I'm saying is, like, our lasting image right now of the Thunder is that offense, and I just like how much they struggled, and like our lasting image is one without Westbrook. And so, you know, it's not like
the offense is so pretty when Westbrook's out there either. It's basically the offense is just, hey, Russell, get open, Kevin, get open. And then just go and try to score.
Yes, we all know your immense disdain for Scotty Brooks.
I wouldn't say it's immense disdain. It's just I get frustrated.
It's immense disdain.
I get frustrated because with so much to work with at his disposal, to be so uncreative and unwilling to
do anything.
Not to do anything. It's just to invent and, you know, play around and try things and see what works. Especially, like, that's a team that knows it's going to have home court advantage. Not necessarily throughout the whole playoffs, but, you know, for at least around every year. They should be more willing to experiment with different things in the regular season. You know, dual point guard lineups, playing Durant at the four. Just move guys around, see what works. Experiment with different sets, experiment with different lineups. It gets me so frustrated that they're not a team that's, you know, pushing to find new things that they can do. Like,
right, given the flexibility of their talent.
Right, and you like, and they're still
playing Perkins and Fisher is just maddening.
Well, yes, that's where I was going next. Like the fact that they're still running Kendrick Perkins out there for, you know, 25, 30 minutes a night every night.
And trying to get him post-ups. Like, it's a conscious thing to throw the ball to.
That's like the first possession every game.
Establish the post. It's like establishing the run, right?
Yeah, you got to establish the big man. I mean, come on. Oh, Kendrick. I feel like I guess it wouldn't have been... Would they have been able to use the full mid-level if they had amnestied Perkins?
Lo wrote about this a bit ago, but I don't know.
I think they could have come very close to using the full mid-level if they had amnesty Perkins. And I feel like if you could have gotten it, like, that's a no-brainer move if you could have gotten the full mid-level out of it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I guess that's a blind spot for Presti as well.
Yeah, it is a little weird that someone who's, you know, as good of a GM as he is still, like,
well, the thing not that,
done anymore.
And, I mean, I'm not going
to... continues to bring back Derek Fisher.
I'm not going to sit here and deny that Sam Presti is a good GM. Obviously, I think he is. But, you know, it was... What he did well was he drafted Westbrook and Durant, and Harden, each in the top four or five picks of the draft. But, you know, he drafted Ibaka as well. But, you know, he's got the Harden trade on his resume. He gave Perkins that massive contract. He keeps bringing back the Derek Fisher experience. So he's got some blemishes on his resume as well. Not that he's not still very good at his job. Obviously, he is. He's one of the better general managers in the league. But I wouldn't – I think, you know, calling him some golden boy saint of a GM – goes too far.
Oh, I agree. Yeah.
Which, it goes too far for everyone if you're calling them that. except for the great, immortal Isaiah Thomas. No response? No response?
Crickets.
Oh, man. This is riveting. It's riveting stuff right here. Do you have anything else to say about the Thunder? I feel like... I feel like there should be more, just because... I feel like...
I want to see... I don't know what to expect. He wasn't at Summer League, so I didn't get to see him play at all. But I just want to see Perry Jones do things.
Yes, Perry Jones. We would have been... We would have disappointed Danny greatly if we did not...
Danny and James.
Yeah, Danny and James, yes. PJ3. I'd love to see him get some burn this year. There you go. Perry Jones should be getting some burn. Play him at the 3, play him at the 4, play him with Durant and Ibaka, play him with just Ibaka, play him with just Durant. Like, that's the kind of guy, or play him with just Collison. Like, move that guy around, try him in different areas, because, I mean, that's an incredibly talented player, and to not try to figure out how to use him in a way that would help the team both this year and going forward. I mean, you have to be able to have young talent come in and transition from being, you know, a nothing player to a bit player to a role player to maybe a starting player someday. And right. To do that, you got to throw him into different situations.
He's got such a great skill set to be like a terrific complementary player to both Durant and Westbrook and Ibaka too. It's like, I just want to see him play basketball this year. I want to see it, Jared. Make it happen.
I mean, what I definitely don't want to see though is like any more of Perkins or Thabeet. It's just like, come on, just stop. What are you doing to me? I mean, what? Steven Adams was a guy though that came into Pitt as like a ridiculously high recruit. Wasn't that great at Pitt, but he's huge and he's athletic, and I think he was funny on draft night, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, it's funny. He's also really damn good at ping pong. I saw him at Daryl Morey's tournament. He's really good.
Just casually dropping that you were at Daryl Morey's ping pong tournament.
Yeah.
I mean, why wouldn't you have been there?
Right.
I mean, is that the kind of guy you think becomes a factor at all at any point? I feel like there's almost no chance.
I don't think so, although I do kind of like what I see out of him, like in flashes in his pick and roll coverage. Because he's athletic enough and he has enough lateral quickness to be able to recover really well and to hedge really well. On offense, I don't know if he's ever going to develop into anything more than just a guy who can finish lobs. Maybe he can get a jump shot at some point, but I do actually think he has some potential on the defensive end.
All right, I think that, you know, we're good there. Let's say of these three teams, the Warriors, the Grizzlies, and the Thunder, which one of those three do you think is most likely to finish outside the top four seeds?
To finish outside the top four, I think Memphis.
So I think I'd go with Golden State. Just because, again, remember, that team won 47 games last year.
Yeah, it's true. I don't know, I think that Iguodala addition, I think that helps them immensely. And I don't know, there's just something about Memphis, and I love watching them play, although sometimes it can just be, like, infuriatingly boring. But like you said, like, they could step back this year, and I think that their potential for a step back is greater than that.
Not even that I think necessarily that they'll step back. Or, oh, you're saying Memphis can step back? Oh, okay. What I was going to say applied to Golden State. Right. If and when Bogut gets hurt, look at who's in their front court. It's Lee is there, and then it's Jermaine O'Neal, Festus Ezeli, Draymond Green, and Maurice Spates.
Hey, Draymond Green's a great player. Did you not see him in the playoffs this year and completely ignore his regular season?
I'm not gonna respond to that. Yeah, I mean Draymond Green looked very nice in the postseason, but you know, I'm gonna go ahead and value the 82 game sample as being more predictive of what he'll be in the future than like the 12-game sample. Even though obviously, I mean, I would expect that, you know, eventually over the course of his career, he'll be closer to the level of play he showed in the playoffs than the level he showed in the regular season. Just because, I mean, you can't possibly shoot as bad as he shot in the regular season. He shot, I don't remember what it was. It was like 32 or 33%. It was something preposterously low.
And he shot 32% just like overall.
Yeah. And then what was he in the playoffs? It was like, I think he shot like 40% from three or something like that.
39% from three and 42% in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't imagine that he's going to shoot 40% from three, but I also wouldn't imagine that he's going to shoot 20% from three.
His effective field goal percentage in the playoffs was 50.9%. In the regular season, it was 35%.
That's Tony Douglas-esque. And with that, I think that that's going to bring the episode to a close. Thanks for listening. Next up, we're going to have the remaining three top teams in the Western Conference, the Clippers, the Rockets, and the Spurs. Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you, Jared.